listening to Cooper Talk.
Welcome to Cooper Talk. I'm your host, Steve Cooper, and remember, I'm only as hip as my guests. I gotta tell you something, people. You know, in the 80s, I was a video junkie. When I was in high school and college, we watched MTV all the time. And my guests had two videos that I loved. I remember when She Blinded Me by Science came out, he had the drove up with a motorcycle with a sidecar and a cool white suit, and we're like, this guy's great. And then Hyperactive, he was just so trippy. He had a ventriloquist dummy, and he's drinking milk, and then all of a sudden the dummy's head pops off, and then all of a sudden the dummy's head has different heads, and it's just amazing. He's had an amazing career, and he's done so much more than those videos. He's doing the Totally Tubular Festival this summer, and his novel, Prevailing Wind, is out, and my guest is Thomas Dolby. How you doing, Thomas?
I'm doing very well, Steve. Good to see you.
Good to see you. I want to start off with the novel, because just the log line, two brothers, a dark secret, and the New York Yacht Club, Hollywood's written all over it. But tell me a little about the novel, and tell me why you decided to write the novel.
I've always had a passion for classic sailboat racing, and I particularly loved the era at the beginning of the last century when the yachts were absolutely huge and gorgeous, and they were mostly owned by robber barons and factory owners and railroad tycoons, and it took 35 to 40 men to man them. And of course, the New York Yacht Club, they wouldn't use their own members with their soft hands to pull the ropes. They went to Deer Isle, Maine, and got a lot of their crews from there because they were hardy lobstermen who were already had leathery hands and didn't feel the cold, and best of all, at night they would lie in their hammocks and read their Bibles instead of going out drinking. So this is really an ideal crew for those guys. So I love the idea of using that as a way to sort of explore the chasm between, you know, wealth and poverty around about the turn of the century. Nothing new, of course, it's still with us. Billionaires are still building yachts and escaping off to, you know, into the blue. And so I wrote this from the point of view of, you know, two young Deer Isle lobstermen who are penniless and whose one chance to get out of poverty is to get signed up for the crew on a wealthy New York Yacht Club owner's yacht. But as well as examining the sailing in a lot of detail, you see them get drawn into an intrigue and a long buried secret at the New York Yacht Club.
Well, you've said you've had a fascination, but what made you sit down and write it? Because I'm thinking, for you, you know, you write music and you're writing a novel now. My background is I do stand-up comedy. Years ago, I optioned a screenplay in Hollywood. A screenplay compared to a novel, it's not even close. Novels are much harder. Music compared to a joke, music's much harder. But for you, when you started writing this novel, did you use the systems you had in place when you wrote music, or was it completely different? Because I would think writing a novel, you have to be very disciplined and you have to be very elaborate. You have to explain everything.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are parallels. I've always had a strong imagination. I think a lot of my songs are very much like little mini stories. You know, they have characters, they have locations, they have mood and atmosphere and emotion and drama, and often a narrative. I'd written my memoir a few years ago, The Speed of Sound. That was pretty easy because that was just like stories that I'd told in regular life, just putting those down on paper. It was like dictation, really. And novel, as you say, is much harder. And the discipline involved is hard, especially when there are sort of thriller and suspense elements, because you have to get the balance just right of leaving enough breadcrumbs to keep people enthralled without actually telegraphing what the outcome is going to be. And as you revise your manuscript, there's all this cross-correlation between different, you know, times and people and places, who knows what and when. And so there's a lot of technique involved, but at the heart of it, the thrust is really a passion, you know, A, my passion for those boats, and B, the passion with which my characters approach this task, which is really their one way, you know, out of the cycle of poverty and a chance to achieve sporting glory as their Deer Isle ancestors did before them.
Now, did you have a regimented schedule when you wrote this? Because I'm sure a song, you have an idea, pops in your head and you go, oh, okay, I'm going to sit down. And even if you don't do it right then, it's on a piece of paper. Well, if you're rewriting a novel, if you don't sit down and you procrastinate, you're going to lose interest because it's not like a song you're going to go back to it. But I mean, did you sit there and have the schedule you said every day? Okay, I'm going to sit down from, because you're a professor too, so you probably tell your students, you know, sit down, do your work, stuff like that. How did you acclimate to that? Did you have a schedule?
Not really. It was COVID that, you know, got me started. And when I'm writing a song, as you say, I mean, I have a germ of an idea. It might be, you know, bubbling up in my mind over a number of years, you know, when I'm out for a walk, when I'm taking a shower, when I'm doing the ironing. This song is constantly evolving. And I suppose that the story of my novel evolved over time, but the actual grunt work of getting it down on paper required some discipline. And because I have, you know, already at least one full-time job as a university professor, I was only really able to do it during sort of school vacations. So that gave me, you know, 2-3 months of the year really to work on the novel. And that's why it's taken me probably 4 years to complete it.
Now, who's harder to work with, from your opinion, record companies or publishers?
Yeah, you know, it's hard to say. I mean, I think in the early 80s, there was a certain naivety about the music business. You probably remember a lot of record company executives were basically fanboys and some fangirls who just thought themselves lucky to be, you know, in the business. And when they encountered an artist like myself that had a lot of ideas of my own, they sort of gave me enough rope. You know, it's like, as long as you're selling some records and making them some money, in those days, they would pretty much leave you alone to your own devices. But I think over time, over the course of the 80s, you know, the music industry really lost that naivety and it became, you know, very data and sales driven. And their tolerance for artists who had, you know, creative ideas of their own you know, became limited, and it became more about, you know, well, we have a formula here, we've broken you through commercially, you need to stick to that formula and milk it a little bit and churn out a few more She Blinded Me With Sciences, when in fact, yeah, you know enough about me to know that I never stay in one place for very long, so the last thing I was going to do was sort of become the British synth boffin, you know, churning out the quirky chart hits.
Well, it's so fascinating that they do that. That's also in the comedy world. You know, you would sit there, you would have your idea of comedy, and then club owners and managers would go, oh, no, it's same as for music. You have to do this. You know, you have to be formulated. And like, well, we want to do that. But then you sit there and go, well, I want to work. You know, you don't want to go and die. But so how did you get involved in music? Nanya, you started singing at a young age, or how did this whole music career happen?
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't from a very musical family. They appreciated it. They didn't participate, really. You know, I used to get out my mother's silver spoon set and sort of play percussion along with Cliff Richard and the Shadows, you know, when I was sort of 6 years old. I had elder siblings, some of whom were Beatle fans. I had a teenage sister who was a Beatle maniac. And when my mum took her to a Beatles Christmas concert in 1964 and couldn't get a babysitter, so she brought me along. That was actually the first concert that I saw.
Wow.
And it was a very famous one. It was the Hammersmith Odeon Christmas concert with a very famous, you know, tall, thin poster. It says The Beatles, The Searchers, Jerry and the Pacemakers, etc. And that concert is very well known among Beatles fans. And I had one opportunity to meet Paul McCartney. He actually came to one of my shows in close to Malibu, where he lives. He came down to an LA show. I met him afterwards, and I said to him, you know, I was at that Christmas 1964 Beatles concert at Hammersmith Odeon, the famous one, thinking that he would remember. And he went, Hammersmith Odeon, we may have played there. And I sort of thought it was stupid of me to think that he would remember a single gig. It's like, Shea Stadium, we may have played there.
Now, you saw that. Now, then did that make you, because I talked to a lot of musicians who say when they saw the Beatles on Ed Sullivan, it changed their life. Did you sit there and say, I want to get into music, or did you start later? Did you wait a little? I mean, it was, you were young, you were how old, 5 at the time? So it, yeah, really wouldn't, so it wouldn't be, it would make an imprint, but at 5 or 6, you really don't know what you're going to do. I mean, I wanted to be a cowboy at 6.
Yeah, but my siblings were playing their records, you know, mostly singles on a little record player, and you know, putting them on repeat. So the songs were so catchy, you know, I was already singing them at, you know, 6 years old. So I think it was really the music that sort of drew me into it. And you would see occasional, you know, photos or pictures in magazines or bits of newsreel or whatever. I think probably when they came to America, you know, Ed Sullivan and the airport riots and things like that, that's when we started to get a lot of newsreel footage of them back in the UK. So they're on TV a lot more in the UK after they came to America. But yeah, I mean, that was how I sort of got into it. And then, I mean, remarkably quickly, they evolved into a much cooler kind of band, you know, less of a pop band and more of a sort of stoner band. You know, you'd get the cover of Sgt. Pepper and pour over it for hours, you know, that sort of gatefold sleeve, like with little bits of Ritzler, you know, paper and tobacco ingrained in it.
So when do you actually start playing music? At what point do you say you start singing? I know you play guitar. I mean, what was your path of being, you know, an amazing synth player? I mean, everyone, you're legendary, you know, for the 80s for that sound, even though you got away from it because you said you didn't want to keep doing it. But when did you start focusing on that?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I was always influenced by older kids. When I was about 10 or 11, I had an older friend that played guitar already or just sort of strummed a few chords. And so that was my first experience with it. But I quickly switched to piano and I was interested, you know, the piano sort of just spoke to me more. So I was mostly self-taught. You know, I sang in a choir at school, so I had some basic knowledge of sort of, you know, harmony and sight reading and things like that. Tried piano lessons, didn't really have the discipline to follow those. So and then synths came along, which you could play with one or two fingers, you know, so that suited me a lot better. And I started to get into that. They were very rare and expensive, though, at the time. So, you know, when I left school at 16 and moved to London, I was working in a fruit and vegetable shop, but I would spend my afternoons in the West End at the music stores where, you know, they would sometimes let me play on a synth for an hour or two. And it would be a mini Moog or something like that, and they'd let you do it on headphones and I sort of pretty much taught myself the basics of it like that, waiting for them to get cheap enough that I could afford my own.
So when you were going to London, when you moved to London, what was the musical landscape like then? What was going on? What was the scene?
Yeah, so what we now call prog rock, you know, but it was Genesis, yes, Pink Floyd, Gentle Giant, Soft Machine, people like that, Frank Zappa. Were very popular, but I was at school with Shane McGowan from the Pogues, who was a brilliant guy, not a very hard worker academically, but an encyclopedic brain and knew everything about music. And he was sort of the guru of music in our particular sort of afternoon coffee bar and cigarette set. And I remember one day him coming in, and we were talking about classic rock, you know, and he goes, "All that stuff, the Beatles, the Stones, it's all crap." We were like, "Huh? What? Yeah, it's all rubbish. They're just a bunch of dinosaurs." We said, "Well, Shane, what should we be listening to?" MC5, New York Dolls, Iggy Pop. And he was naming all of these people we'd never heard of, you know. And to my, you know, deep horror, when I was able to sort of go to the Virgin record store and listen to some of those bands, they played like three or four chords, and it was the opposite, absolute antithesis of progressive rock. And I was deeply, you know, hurt by this. But my reaction was very similar to the reaction of the music scene when the Sex Pistols and the UK punk came along. You know, we were absolutely dumbfounded that these kids, you know, I mean, I remember the first NME review of the Sex Pistols at the Marquee, and it said, "They spat, they swore, they walked off the stage in a half hour, 25 minutes. Who do the Sex Pistols think they are?" And, of course, within about 6 months, I mean, you know, things change very rapidly in the UK. It's just a little island. So within a few months of that, the music industry had turned onto punk, and they were all denying that they owned, you know, a triple Yes album. And now they were, you know, very much in the wake of the same thing that Shane was putting forward, you know, in that cafe, was it was just really ripe for some rebellion. And I think that energy, you know, cultural energy, never left me, really. I mean, you know, punk music is not my music, but there's a certain piece of punk about what I do, even when I'm using electronics and samplers and synthesizers.
Well, I think it's because also it's edgy and it's different, and that seems what you wanted to get across. I mean, even when you think about Blinded by Science, it's not the normal 80s song back then. I mean, and so there's a different edge to it. And you're right, punk, when we first heard, I was older when I first heard punk, and my friend was wearing a blazer, and he's like, and he had his hair spiked up, and he's like, "You gotta listen to the Sex Pistols." And he had the cassette, and I was like, "Holy shit, that's great!" You know, I was like, "This is," and it was something different because, you know, I'm from New Jersey. We had, you know, Billy Joel played on the radio, Bon Jovi, Springsteen, which I'm a huge fan, but it was like, it was something different. And then it's funny because that's like with the 80s, with your music, when we, you know, we saw how you guys dressed and we saw a different sound. And I was lucky to have a friend in college who was from Hong Kong. So he brought us Roxy Music and he brought us Ultravox and all this music we wouldn't have heard. But then MTV is where we found all the UK acts because we weren't, that classic rock wasn't playing it. So when do you start working on getting a career and a record deal? When does that happen? You're influenced by punk, but you have the keyboards. What age did you buy your first keyboard? Did you finally get a chance to buy a keyboard?
Yeah, I mean, I got my first keyboard as about 17, 18, something like that. I mean, I think an electric piano was the first thing I got, and then a string synthesizer, and then the Micromoog, which was the first really affordable sort of single voice, single note synthesizer from the Moog company. And I had a little two-track tape recorder, which allowed you to sort of ping-pong back and forth from the left to right tracks and sort of to overdub, you know. It's like before you could get multi-tracks that you could own at home. And the studio at that point was like way out of reach. I mean, you dreamed of ever being allowed into a recording studio. But I honed my keyboard skills, and my first professional job, you know, in the music industry was playing keyboards for a guy called Bruce Woolley in a band called Bruce Woolley and the Camera Club. And Bruce, you know, was signed to a record label. He had co-written an international number one, Video Killed the Radio Star. His former friends in the Buggles had had the hit with that, and he sort of took up on his own in a slightly more sort of new romantic, sort of rocky direction, you know, more in the vein of a Duran Duran or someone like that. And so I honed my skills, you know, playing with him, and quickly moved from there to Lena Lovitch, for whom I wrote a song called New Toy, which was a hit in the US. And suddenly record companies were starting to hear my playing and know the name. So when I at that point approached them with demos of my own, you know, it's like having a sort of back way in. And so I managed to get a record deal with EMI, got my own, you know, for my own label, Venice in Peril, which they distributed. And like I said, they gave me enough rope, you know, they gave me the freedom to do what I wanted. I was invited to go to New York to play with Foreigner on Foreigner 4. And I did songs for them like Waiting for a Girl Like You and Urgent and so on. Came back with an envelope full of cash, and that basically paid for my first album. So I you know, put that back into my career and made the Golden Age of Wireless with the cash that I'd earned playing with Foreigner.
Well, it's funny whether you say you wrote for Lena Lovitch. Now, you also wrote a song for Houdini, right? Which, that's to me, that's like, wait a second, because I think of Houdini, the Freaks Come Back out at Night. But how did that happen? Like, how did you start getting hired to write songs? Does word travel? Like, oh yeah, you know, that Thomas Stelby's really good. I mean, and even like for the session musicians, like Foreigner, I mean, you would think Foreigner had a keyboardist because Al Greenwood was their original keyboardist, and they're Urgent. I mean, that's a known keyboard lick. I mean, you played a known keyboard lick, but how did your name get out in that part of writing a song for Lena Lovitch or Houdini, or getting Foreigner saying, oh, come on over to New York?
Mutt Lange is the answer to that. Mutt Lange, one of the world's greatest producers, known for AC/DC and The Cars and Shania Twain and lots of bands over the years, produced that Foreigner 4 album. And he and his South African, some of his partners in London, had basically a hit factory called Zomba. And Zomba were one of the first UK companies to get turned on to the sort of New York electronic club scene, you know, people like Afrika Bambaataa, Grandmaster Flash and so on, and that whole sort of South Bronx dance scene, which in turn was influenced by European electronic music. Kraftwerk, you know, got sampled left, right and center by DJs there, and people would rap over the top. So Zomba recognized that there was this cross-pollination going on in that area, and they had studios in North London, which on downtime they would put their artists in there and say, just come up with something and we'll figure out what to do with it. So, you know, around about the time of Sublime Mere Science, I was working on a bunch of different grooves. I was working on, you know, an idea for a song that never really came together that had this particular groove and bass riff in it. And Zomba suggested that they took it to New York and found somebody to rap over the top of it. And so Houdini were the were the contenders, and became a massive club hit there, and actually got me into the Hip Hop Hall of Fame, which is a bit weird, but it's kind of great.
So you have this pile of cash. You can start your record. So now, how long? I know Blinded by Science wasn't on the first version, right? That came out later. How was that? How did it happen? I mean, did you think that Blinded by Science would take off? Or I mean, what was your focus on your first album?
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't really. I wasn't trying to be commercial, you know. I was just sort of making a statement. You know, it was like, this is a slice of my music at this point in time. The Golden Age of Wireless came out around the world. Didn't make a huge impression. It got some good reviews. Won a couple of minor awards, and EMI sent me off to different European territories to sort of do, you know, pop TV and radio shows and things like that. And they instantly wanted me to start working on the next album. And the first couple of songs I did were She Blinded Me With Science and One of Our Submarines. And She Blinded Me With Science came out as a single in the UK and immediately started getting a lot of club play in the US in urban dance clubs. And my record company sort of picked up on that and said, you know, we actually think this album still has life. If we repackage it and put She Blinded Me With Science and One of Our Submarines on it, we think that we could sell a bunch of records. So that's exactly what they did. And Science took off really, I think, because of MTV. It was right at the moment when MTV had sort of fully penetrated the major cities, major markets. And like yourself, cool people were staying at home on a Saturday night to watch MTV instead of going out to gigs, you know, and everybody was talking about it. And in you know, small town America, like you say, they were seeing the way that we dressed and the things that we did. And, you know, kids that had cable TV were the coolest kids in school because they were wearing Devo T-shirts and they had all sorts of, you know, cool songs up their sleeve that the rock and roll kids, you know, songs that they weren't hearing on mainstream radio. So it was a very, very pivotal time.
So yeah, as I said earlier, I talked about the videos. Both of those videos are very innovative, especially Hyperactive. Now, did you have any say in the videos? Because you seem like someone, when you see them and then you hear your music, you think, he's involved. Because I know a lot of times the record company would go, okay, we're going to get an unknown David Fincher. He's going to come in, we're going to pay him a shitload of money. He's going to direct it, and the bands have nothing to do. Did you have any input in your videos?
Yeah, well, I mean, you're right that the early days of videos, record companies would hire independent directors, producers to come in and make the videos, and the bands just sort of went along with it. You know, stand here, wear this gear, mime your song a couple of times, and we'll edit it and put it out. But when MTV took off and was clearly such a potent force, I think a lot of creative artists thought, I'm not just going to let some independent producer come up with my look, and you know, this is as important as the record. So along with myself, people like Peter Gabriel and Kate Bush, Talking Heads, Laurie Anderson, insisted that we got creatively involved in the making of the videos. So in fact, with She Blinded Me With Science, the first thing I came up with before I even had the song was a storyboard for a video. It was designed as a video from the outset. And it had a concept to it and a title, and that was about it. And the next thing I had was a groove, and then everything else sort of fell into place. I loaded multiple hooks over the top of the groove, but the video was what really gave it its identity. So yeah, I was very involved in that. And you know, to give credit to EMI, they gave me the budget. I mean, I hired a professional production company, but I wrote and directed it myself, having never directed anything. And had a great time doing it. On Hyperactive, I had a collaborator, Danny Kleinman, who directed the video, but we pretty much came up with the concept ourselves. You know, Danny was really the first with many of those types of effects, really sort of mixing up physical effects like, you know, a box with photographs that you tear off right. Different faces. And video effects, which, of course, in those days, you know, were very scarce, and the boxes were very expensive, and it took forever to render them, and so you couldn't be that experimental. You know, the computers were not fast in those days, but you know, Danny, who is a brilliant, he did a bunch of the James Bond graphics,
okay,
you know, from the 90s onwards, and he was a commercial director, very creative guy, and you know, the look of Hyperactive is very much his doing.
Now Blinded takes off, gets a big hit. How is that changing you and your career? Because all of a sudden now you have a hit, and you know they're going to put you out on the road. I'm sure. I mean, who were they trying to pair you up with when you would tour? Because it has to be a certain fit. Like that's what you know. I was thinking about. I went to see the Police, Joan Jett, REM, and Madness at JFK, which is a big stadium in Philly, years ago, and it sounded like a very different. You know, setup. I mean, different bands, very different genres, but it was something big. How were they putting you out on the road, and how were they representing you? I mean, what were you getting pitched as a synth act, or how were they saying, pitching you and pairing you?
Yeah, I mean, that's hard to say. They didn't really put me on the road per se. I mean, I was never a big tourer. You know, I've done obviously a fair few in my time, but it wasn't sort of months of touring on end. So that there wasn't really that sort of pairing to be done. What was happening was that my music was getting noticed by a wide variety of my peers and people that I respected in the industry. And it was really thrilling to get a call from, you know, Joni Mitchell or some of the different bands that I worked with, George Clinton, you know, the most diverse range of different artists. I would bump into and they'd say, oh, I love your stuff. You know, it's like, what can we do together? Back in England, there was a band called Prefab Sprout that I absolutely adored that needed a sort of mentor and producer. And so I did a couple of albums for them. I was starting to get invited to work on film projects. I did a bit of film scoring, which, you know, I'd always aspired to do. So all these interesting offers were coming in. And it was like the early rounds of Monopoly, where you pretty much buy into every square that you land on. I was leading a thrilling life. And I think the record company, probably because this was getting so much media coverage and my name kept cropping up all these different places, I don't think they ever worried that I needed to spend more time out on the road and getting in front of people. So touring was never that big a deal for me. When I had a band, they'd be session players. You know, I didn't really have a regular band per se. And I mean, it was more about media, more about TV and radio appearances and so on.
Now, for TV appearances, I'm sure, were you on Top of the Pops?
Yeah, several times. Yeah.
Tell me about that, because, you know, people don't get it. Like, for us, growing up, we had The Tonight Show. And I had a friend, Tom Dreesen, a legendary comic. He was living in his car. And he did The Tonight Show. Next thing you know, he's in Vegas opening for Julio Iglesias. And his whole life changed. Tell me about if you remember your first time on Tops of the Pops, because it's fascinating how everybody watched that show.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, the UK, you know, Britain's a small island. And there were three TV channels at that point, you know, two BBC and one ITV. And BBC One on Thursday night had Top of the Pops. And something like 2/3 of the population of Britain tuned into that show. Of course, those numbers can't be repeated now because you've got 500 different, you know, channels to watch. And the producers of the show were the same producers of Radio 1, which is the pop radio station that everybody listened to. So basically, you know, if you got on Top of the Pops, it probably meant you'd get on the Radio 1 A-list as well. And it would mean that the next week when you checked out the charts, your record had jumped, you know, 12, 15 places. If you weren't on those shows, it was very hard to climb up the charts. So that was really the way that the British public discovered music in those days. And the BBC had this big round building in White City where the studio was. And, I mean, you would find out on a Tuesday whether or not you were going to shoot the show on a Wednesday. Tuesday night, you would go into the studio to supposedly re-record your single in 3 hours. This was something that the union insisted on so that they wouldn't avoid repaying musicians. Of course, nobody could record a single. You know, it's Frankie Goes to Hollywood re-recording Relax in 3 hours is just a ridiculous idea. So there's a bit of, you know, jiggery pokery went on with swapping of tapes and things like that. Then Wednesday you would go to the studio and you walk in there and you walk around the circular corridor of this building looking at the names on the stars on the doors. And I'm going, okay, Spandau Ballet, Duran Duran, Thomas Dolby, oh, there I am. Okay, that would be your dressing room. And you'd get changed and they'd haul you out there in front of teenagers sort of dancing around and you would mime to your hit. And you would look forward to having a huge jump in the charts next week. It was really the be-all and end-all of everything in the UK. Touring didn't matter. You know, TV was not yet, regular TV and cable were not yet an issue. So it was the biggest single factor in having a success in the UK.
Well, I was surprised, and I didn't know this until I was doing a little research on you. I did not know you played at Live Aid. And the funny thing about Live Aid is, you know, you play with David Bowie. I grew up 10 minutes from Philadelphia. It was in, one of them was in Philly, but I remember I was down the Jersey Shore, which is an hour, and we missed it. But it was like, and my now wife, she said she could have gone, but there was no cell phone, so they're trying to call her. She was visiting her friends. But what was that like? Because I've had so many people that are on the show. It must have been fascinating. I mean, Kenny Jones told me a story. He flew out and all this. What was it like for you? Because you're playing in front of everybody. It must have been, was it nerve-wracking?
Well, it was nerve-wracking because we'd had very little time to rehearse with Mr. Bowie. He was in London anyway because he was shooting a movie called Labyrinth. And he was up very early every day and shooting all day. And we got him for about 3 hours a night, for three nights on the trot. And he kept changing his mind about what songs we were going to do. He went into it thinking, I'll promote my current single, which was Loving the Alien. And then as he got closer to it, he realized it wasn't about promotion. It was really about raising money for the cause and coming up with the anthems that people wanted to hear and sing along with. So he only settled on the four songs that we eventually did. I think really the day of the gig. In fact, we flew in there, and as we stood at the side of the stage, Bowie nudged me in the ribs and said, let's start with TVC 1-5. And that was when my stomach really hit the floor, because that's like a honky-tonk piano solo played by, I think, Mike Garston originally, who's a brilliant pianist. And it's really not my style at all. So the idea of like kicking off a Bowie set in front of 120,000 people and a billion more on TV with a style of piano that is really not my thing was certainly quite intimidating. We'd never actually played those four songs back to back. We did TVC 1-5, Modern Love, Rebel Rebel, and Heroes. We played them all with him in the studio, but we'd never played them straight through as a set. So that was kind of weird, but we were, you know, the band were of the generation that grew up with Bowie, and we knew every note of every song he ever did. So it's like, I didn't really know it, but I kind of knew it, you know, and my fingers basically played themselves, and it was a transcendental experience.
Now, you had mentioned the record companies earlier. After Blinded by Science became a hit, were they making you try to do another hit? Like, I know you're the Total Tubular Tour, Men Without Hats is going to be there. And Ivan Dorchak told me that they wanted him, you know, they wanted him to come up with another Safety Dance. You know, you have to come up with that. How was the record company looking towards you? Because you had a hit. Were they pressuring you? Because it was a matter of, do they want that same sound? Or because you've gone in different directions. But what were they asking you?
They were asking me to make them lots of money. And I think, you know, retroactively, if I look back 40 years, when I think of how lucky I've been to have written an evergreen hit that, you know, keeps paying the rent year in, year out, I sometimes go, well, couldn't I have just taken a few months and just churned out a few more, you know? And that's their point of view, you know, that their point of view is it's so hard to break an act through that once you crack it, it should be a piece of cake. You know, the low-hanging fruit is there. And that is when you have a song like Safety Dance or She Blinded Me, it's like, oh, come on, surely you could whip off a couple more like that. Because we have a winning formula that we know it works. We know that radio will take something so long as it sounds like the last one. I wasn't willing to do that because I have to keep pushing my horizons. The closest I came, I think, was with Hyperactive, which I think deserved to be a top five hit as well. But actually got immersed in some politics of the time. All sorts of crap with independent promotion and you know, MTV record companies wanted their own MTV, or they wanted to get paid for MTV content. And I got caught in the middle of that, and the record seemed to be doing really well for a couple of weeks, and then it's mysteriously bombed out. And I wasn't the only artist that had that problem with my label. So that was a bit of a shame, because I think that's one of the catchiest songs I've ever written. I think it was a deserved to be you know, the true sort of sequel to She Blinded Me With Science. In the UK and most other territories in the world, Hyperactive was actually a bigger hit than She Blinded Me With Science. So, you know, I'll be walking down the street and somebody will start whistling the melody from it, you know, as they walk up behind me.
Now, you start changing your directions in your music. How does the record company react to that? Are they saying, we don't want this? Because it's legendary. People would just drop people back then. I mean, the record company was cutthroat. I mean, how was it doing when you came with a whole new different sound? What would they think?
You know, they don't talk to artists like that, or at least they didn't in those days. They might have talked to my manager like that, and then managers sort of parse it into artist speak. People treated artists with kid gloves, and I think rightly so. We were delicate little things, and, you know, we don't like to be told, you know, do it this way or we'll drop you, because we'll probably have a tantrum and throw the toys out of the pram, you know, and that nobody wants that. So, you know, you learn when you sign to a label, you learn quite early on that you kind of have to play the game to an extent. But there's also this factor of, at the end of the day, they don't understand what you do. They don't. If they did, they would be doing it themselves. They'd love to be doing that, but they're not magicians, and you are. And so, to an extent, they give you, you know, they give you enough rope to hang yourself. And I think in my case, you know, you have multi-album deals. The options are all on the record company's side. And if you owe them one, they'll wait for you to deliver it and give it a good listen. And then they will sort of rank it in their own minds, probably not publicly, but in their own minds, they'll put an estimate of what they can expect to sell on this. And if they don't expect to sell a ton of records, they're not going to put their marketing resources behind it in the way they would with a surefire hit. And I think that's what happened to me. I was doing increasingly experimental stuff, more and more personal, and they weren't really interested in, you know, in an art house act.
Now, what made you walk away? I mean, you walked away from music, and it's a matter of, you know, like anything. We are, I always say, anyone who's an artist is a little bit insecure and a little bit narcissistic. We want to be seen, we feel, oh, you know, we want to be appreciated. For you, you had that big hit. When you walked away, did you ever have in your mind that you wanted to write another Blinded by Science? I mean, what made you stop recording?
You know, I never thought I would write another Blinded by Science, really. It was in a sort of extreme end of my, you know, musical sensibility. It was a sort of a musical joke, really. I'm perfectly proud of it. You know, I think it's great for what it is. It's not like every time I have to play it, it fills me with revulsion. I'm happy to play it, and people love it still. But no, I mean, I just have to keep searching for the new thing. And by the end of the 80s, what that was technology. I'd been increasingly using computer-based software to make my music. I'd started consulting with some of the companies that made that software. I was in LA, they were in Silicon Valley mostly. And I would fly up there and work with them on new suggestions, new ideas for features. And if I was lucky, they would get integrated for the next version. And that was a bug that really caught hold of me. And it caught hold of me at a time when the internet was first starting to become, you know, a huge factor in, you know, for investors and for technologists. And so you could find a rich guy that was willing to write you a check, you know, over a cup of coffee on the back, you know, based on a business plan you wrote in the back of an envelope. So I came up with this idea for a company, for a tech company, making interactive music software. And I was lucky enough to get venture capital funding for it. And that funding basically lasted with us in the red, you know, until the end of the century, you know, until and at a time when, you know, by then many dot-com companies were going up in smoke. And my company, Beatnik, would have gone that way were it not for one deal, because we never made any money on the internet at all. You know, we had millions of downloads, millions of subscribers, never made a cent. But the one area that we had that was real business was mobile phones. And Nokia came along. We created this synthesizer that was designed to be extremely efficient. It's a software-based synthesizer, not a hardware synthesizer. And it was designed to be extremely efficient for loading quickly over the internet. But Nokia saw it, and they were looking for something to put in their phones to do polyphonic ringtones. And so they asked us if we could send engineers to Nokia to port our technology to Nokia cell phones. And it was a success, and they started embedding it in their phones. And the Beatnik synthesizer is what you hear when you hear that di 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 di, you know. And it shipped in billions and billions of cell phones in the early part of the 21st century.
So it's just fascinating. I was just saying earlier, your career is so fascinating. And then now, how do you become a professor? I mean, it's someone you've worn so many hats, and you used to wear great hats. That's why I wear this hat. I usually wear a schoolboy hat, but I wore this hat. How did you become a professor? Because I mean, as I said, right now, most people will go, I had a tech company that's successful. I've had a huge record company. I've played Live Aid. So is it something that, as you said, you always wanted to grow? I mean, did you want to teach, or I mean, how did that all happen to come at John Hopkins, which, you know, when we grew up, everyone, it was known for a great school, but it was known for lacrosse. Everyone said, oh, John Hopkins has a great lacrosse team. But how did you end up at John Hopkins? And it's and the Peabody Institute, I mean, you really, it's amazing.
Yeah, you know, I always wanted to give something back. I mean, I mentioned earlier I left school at 16. I could have gone to college if there'd been a college degree available in the UK that dealt with electronic music and experimental film and all the stuff that I was into, but there was really nothing like that. So I'm pretty much self-taught, you know, from start to finish. And each new chapter of my career, I had to learn a new set of skills by trying and failing and doing and succeeding. And I wished that I'd had a mentor through that could have shown me those things, but there was nobody. You know, I was pioneering new areas, so there was nobody to show me that stuff. So I feel at this point, you know, it's time to give something back and to pass that knowledge on. And I think it's especially important in an era when, you know, college-age kids today believe that any sort of a problem that they encounter, they can get the answer with a few key presses. You know, and I think especially now with AI and so on, it can write their essays for them, and pretty soon it'll be able to write their musical submissions as well. And in order to find their own true individual voice, which is going to be increasingly important, you know, as more and more content is put out there that is mediocre, to have an individual personal voice that really expresses what you have on the inside out requires a mindset that I think can be taught. And so I think, you know, showing them examples from my career and the way that I do things, which is not about theory or you know, textbooks or whatever, it's about the creative mindset and learning to work with limited resources. You know, you can't just type in your question to Chat GPT and get the answer. You need to figure it out for yourself. And so I will lock them in a room with their devices turned off and say, right, you've got this drum machine and that synthesizer, and you've got 20 minutes to compose dot 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 fill in the blanks. And then afterwards we all play each other our pieces, and they critique each other, and they become like a team, a little mini community that are all lifting themselves up. And that's something that I wished I'd had, you know, when I was college age and there was nothing available. So I love the fact that, you know, Johns Hopkins have given me the opportunity to do that now at the Peabody Institute, and that's the program that I've created down here in Baltimore.
It's so funny when you say about college. You know, we had to go to the library and get those newspapers on the roll, or get microfiche. And now, like my niece, she's just like, oh, Wikipedia, or you know, anything. So you're doing, you have a little something going. What made you start performing again?
Yeah, I mean, I love it. I love doing it. I'm essentially quite a shy person and not all that comfortable in social situations, but I have a thin streak of extreme exhibitionism. And a lot of what I do, I sort of reverse engineer from that moment when there's an empty spotlight on the stage and a guy walks into it, sits down at his instrument, starts to play. What does that sound like? Like I envision that, I visualize that, and then I work backwards from that and figure out what it was that he played. And that becomes my song. So the moment where, you know, as it were, the rubber meets the road is absolutely vital. When the audience gets to hear that right from the artist's mouth, that's irreplaceable. And however great AI ever gets, you know, it's not going to replace that human interaction. So it's a special, rarefied moment in any artist's life to be face to face with an audience. So I really enjoy it. And you have to put up with a lot of crap, you know, to get out on the road and do it. But it's becoming increasingly easier. It's so much easier now than it used to be. With the internet and with travel and communication, cell phones, all the rest of it. And so, you know, touring can be a joy. And so I'm really looking forward to this Totally Tubular tour.
Yeah, I want to ask you that. It's such an amazing lineup. I mean, and you sit there, and so I guess, and then you were playing some one-offs with a few with just you and Tom Bailey, but you know, did you know a lot of these people that were on that are coming on the tour? I mean, how did they put this lineup together? Because it's stocked full of just great. It's especially for us '80s people. It's like, because I'm gonna go see you guys in Atlantic City. It's like it's a great lineup. How did you guys figure this out? Did you work with someone, or do you have input, or and did you know each other?
Yeah, there's an agent promoter called John Pleater who put the thing together. He has the Totally Tubular brand was his idea. When he first approached me around about Christmas, it was going to be me and Tom Bailey of the Thompson Twins and the Human League. Human League pulled out quite early on. And John approached me and said, look, how do you feel about finishing the show? And I said, you mean headlining? He goes, well, it's not really headlining. I mean, you know, you're all equal, but we'd like you to close the show. I said, well, why me? He said, well, you know, you are not Thomas Dolby of Fill in the Blanks. You are not the legacy act that is like a borderline tribute act because you've only got one original member from the original lineup. You know, you never split up. You never in and out of rehab. You're you, but you don't tour that much. You don't tour year in, year out. So you will be viewed as a sort of authentic gem of the 80s that it may be people's one chance to see you. And so we think that you would be a very prestigious act to put, you know, at the top of the bill there. So it's like, well, how could I say no to that? That seems like a great opportunity. And it's going to be fun as hell being out with all of those guys. You know, when we were in our 20s, back in the Top of the Pops days, we were very snooty to each other. There's a lot of competition. And but, you know, you get to a certain age and all of that goes, it's going to be great.
Now, what do you think made the 80s so special? You know, I talk to people that are like from college, oh, I miss the 80s. And I miss the 80s, but I'm glad I'm not in the 80s anymore. You know, except I could gel my hair and now I'm bald. So I had that look, the Duran Duran look. But what do you think it is that makes the 80s last? Because people are still fanatical about it. And Jack from Wang Chung said it was because the songs were just catchy and you enjoyed it. But what do you think made the 80s so special that we still, I mean, people dress up in 80s outfits. Like when you do your show, there'll be people dressed up in 80s outfits. What do you think made it so special?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think it was the diversity and the fact that it was unexpected. And I think, because it's not the only decade where there were catchy songs, right, in terms of what Wang Chung said about it. I mean, the 60s, 70s, there have always been catchy pop hits. I think the 70s was really the first decade when the music industry became an industry. And I think between disco and sort of AOR rock and so on, I think the industry figured out how to turn it into a marketable product. And I think the audience had a dose of that. I think, you know, listeners had a dose of that and they didn't like the corporate way that it had gone. And I think that MTV was really a disruptor because I think that absent MTV, I think radio would have gone down its path going more and more sort of formulaic in terms of the programming. And that's like a funnel that encourages artists to be more and more homogenized if they want to get on the radio. MTV came along and suddenly it wasn't about the sound of your record. You know, the quirkier the sound was of your record and the more bizarre the video, the more rotation you would get on MTV. So it sort of spawned a wide variety of different directions in music. You still had the residue of punk, and so you had bands like, I don't know, Blondie, who, you know, started out as a punk band but then went very mainstream pop, but they still had that punk energy. You know, you had Talking Heads who were out of art school and so were more in the sort of, you know, Roxy Music mold where you know, it's interesting music, and REM later, you know, music that was stimulating intellectually as well as, you know, foot tapping. You had people like Bowie and the Stones were sort of still going and still turning stuff out. And then you had, you know, lots of mainstream rock, you know, big stadium bands that, you know, the later on sort of U2 and people like that, Phil Collins, that could fill stadiums and really made anthemic sounding records that would work in a big stadium arena. So that there was just this incredible diversity, and sort of suddenly music had become very layered and nuanced. And I think that's why people have fond memories of it. You know, I think these things go in cycles. I think I was just very lucky to be part of a very exciting wave of music in the early 80s.
Two more questions. One, I always ask my guests this because I always get different answers. What, when you look back on your career, and I said it's been so multifaceted, what are a few things that make you proud about your career? That, you know, you sit there and you feel like, you know, like that inner pride. What are a few things that just make you feel proud?
I think I'm proud that I never really sold out. You know, it's like that I kept being motivated mostly by my sense of adventure. You know, I'm sort of a musical explorer, and I was able to always pick the exciting artistic or creative avenue to go down. And, you know, miraculously, I never had my car repossessed or my house taken away or anything like that. You know, I seem to be making enough money to sustain my lifestyle and to allow me to be as creative as I wanted without having to make any compromises. So I think that's a tricky road to pursue. And I think many people sort of came unstuck, you know, in that sort of chasm between art and commerce. And I managed to pretty much, you know, leapfrog over that chasm and do, you know, my best work at every stage of my career. And that's what I'm most proud of.
And finally, give me a good 80s story from when your music was big. I always love, if everyone has stories you can name drop, you can do whatever. Give me a good story to close the show out. 80s musical story.
I once performed at a James Brown testimonial concert in Washington, D.C. And I was asked by George Clinton and the P-Funk All-Stars to come on stage and do a version of Sex Machine, which several of them had played on. You know, Bootsy and Catfish Collins had played on it. Some of the brass players had played on the original Sex Machine. It was a testimonial for James Brown in this big auditorium. So I get on stage, the only white guy in the house, get on stage, and I look down the front row, and there is James Brown. And he's scowling at me. And I'm wearing a white suit, and I've got my sort of spiky hair. And I break into my best Oxford accent. And I'm going, get up, get on up, stay on the scene like a sex machine. And it absolutely brought the house down. And I was supposed to play the piano solo in the middle. And they had a piano there, like a Fender Rhodes there for me. And I go over to play it, and I start plunking on the keys. There's no sound at all. So I kicked it over and started kicking the heck out of it, and then went back very calmly to get up, get on up, stay on the scene like a sex machine. And they absolutely loved it. And I was just a deity as a, you know, backstage afterwards. They were just like, I am not worthy, you know. So that was a very special moment for me.
That was awesome. Thanks so much, Thomas. Now, how can people get Prevailing Wind? Where can they find Prevailing Wind?
Yeah, so it's on Amazon. It actually went live yesterday. The paperback's on there for $24.99. There's a hardback and an ebook coming out on the 25th of June for $39 and $5.99 for the ebook. So I think you'll enjoy it. It's very different. You know, it's about classic sailboats in the early part of the 20th century, owned by robber barons and sailed by penniless lobstermen from Maine. So, and it's sort of a mystery. But so even if you don't like sailing, you'll get into it.
And I think Hollywood's going to be come knocking on your door because they need original. They need good stories. So people, go see the Totally Tubular Festival. You can find everything on Thomas's website, thomasdolby.com. It's got the concert information. It's got the book. You can go to my website, coopertalk.net. You can find over 1,010 episodes there. You can email me at cooper@coopertalk.net. Twitter, I'm at coopertalk. Also, June 27th, Soundplex Studios in Pensauken, the hippest, hottest new production studio in the tri-state area. I will be hosting my twice-a-month show, Speakeasy Stand-Up. I have a great lineup. It's a beautiful venue. Come out. Once again, cooper@coopertalk.net to get ticket information. So once again, I'm Steve Cooper. I'm only as hip as my guests. Don't forget, drink your water, eat your vegetables, take your vitamin, and I'll talk to you next time.